wondering whether you're going to be here because I heard you weren't feeling super well yesterday. Good. Okay. Be sure to, that solves that problem. Be sure to get pack part two of your packets. They have been in the bookstore for a number of days, and you'll need these for the readings right afterwards. Okay. We're starting a kind of transition period in the course, and I'd like to do this by reflecting with you a little bit on the shift from science to technology to more specific environmental concerns. One of the questions that arises is the extent to which Ian Barber is right when he argues that the driving force in science is curiosity and the desire to know, and that the desire for technological control is secondary. I would like to believe that is true, and I think it very well may have been true to some considerable degree of some of the earlier scientists, particularly those who in some cases were independently wealthy, who did science in part almost as a hobby. But on the other side of that, I find that I am fairly well convinced by the kinds of arguments that William Lice makes in his little book, The Domination of Nature. Lice is a kind of neo-Marxist writer who I think rightly points to the fact that at least in the last three centuries or so, the driving force behind science seems to be the desire for technological control of our environment and of ourselves. I think this is very clear in terms of the funding of science and the close relation between science and the military, close relation between science and agriculture and all kinds of economic development. I don't know that we'll ever resolve that problem, but I thought it would be interesting to look at just a little bit of the background of it. I wish we had about 2 weeks to do this because it's a fascinating subject. I draw rather heavily from Lice's book, L-E-I-S-S, William Lice, The Domination of Nature, but also from quite a variety of other sources. Lice points out that in the modern world, we have until very recently, that is, until perhaps the time of the World War, tended to be casually optimistic about the role of modern science. World War I was more of a turning point in Europe, shifting away from the kind of ebullient optimism that characterized the last part of the 19th century. I think it wasn't until the Great Depression of the 30s that this country became more pessimistic, and in some ways it wasn't until World War II and the advent of the atom bomb and so on that that shift fully took place. The older view was that we would learn the secrets of nature, we would gain control over nature, life, that is society and the life of the individual, would inevitably improve because of knowledge, because of science and technology. And it seems to me that this was a period in the late 19th and early 20th centuries when we pretty much ignored some of the warnings of the ancient myth makers, some of the old Greek myths and so on, because they often reflected considerable fear of human technology, a fear of our technical skills, a fear that when we came to control the fire of the gods, we might improve our lot for a time, but we might also destroy ourselves. This is an ancient fear. We see it just in many, many cases, this sense that knowledge could be the source of salvation, but also perhaps even more likely of damnation, that there might be an element of the demonic in our relentless quest for more and more knowledge about nature and more power over nature. We see this, I think, in the ancient legend of Daedalus and his son Icarus. Daedalus, he was a legendary artist, a craftsman, an inventor archaic times. His name has particular significance, for artful works were referred to in Greek as Daedala. He was born in Athens, but he had to leave the city suddenly because he killed his nephew Perdix, who surpassed him in skill. He went to Crete. He was exiled, where, among other things, he fashioned, as the myth goes, the labyrinth for the Minotaur. He was later imprisoned by King Minos along with his son Icarus. And as an attempt to escape, he fashioned these wings that were held together partly by wax. And as he and his son escaped from the prison, he warned his son not to fly too close to the sun, but his son, in his youthful enthusiasm, Icarus flew too close to the sun, as the story goes, and the wax and the wings melted, and he fell to his death in the sea. And clearly the story represents some of this sense of foreboding, that when we learn how to fashion things technologically, that they might destroy us as well as save us. It's fascinating how at the beginning of the modern scientific era, someone like Francis Bacon, this would be early 17th century, interprets the myth. He simply takes Daedalus' admonition to his son to fly neither too close, neither too high nor too low, as a kind of vulgar reminder that we ought to steer a kind of median course in life. We ought to avoid extremes. And thus, I think Francis Bacon quite fails to see the power of the myth, the sense of foreboding that ancient man had regarding technological development. It's fascinating to contrast that with someone nearer our own day, Bertrand Russell, who comments on the myth and sees far deeper implications in it. In his pessimistic writing, Icarus or the Future of Science, Bertrand Russell took Icarus to represent, quote, not just a particular misjudgment, but the fate of an entire civilization which had dedicated itself to the pursuit of scientific progress. Now, at the turn of the century, Russell's position would have seemed to most readers as unduly gloomy and pessimistic. I think today, if anything, many of us would see Russell's writing as too optimistic, because more and more over the last 50 years or so, we have seen that science could bring about a kind of dystopia as well as a utopia, a world worse than the one we actually have, that it could destroy us and that it would be anything but an unambiguous good. Now, various writers, Mircea Eliade, Eliade, the historian of religions, and others have looked at the connection between science, technology, and culture, and specifically at the connection between medieval magic and alchemy and the rise of modern science. And Eliade, in books like his writing The Forge and the Crucible, that looks at the development of mining historically, it's an utterly fascinating book. It would make a nice term paper to take a book like that and look at it in terms of modern science. He refers in the book to the sense of the sacredness of metal. He refers to the strange and mysterious character of mining and other metallurgical operations, that there was a sense that this was somehow an enormous shift in human culture, that when we learned to work with metals, that we were playing with something really quite dangerous. There was a sense, he points out from the evidence, that no one might really control these new skills and their products, particularly weapons of war. It's an ancient fear. And I think in terms of what's happened in my own lifetime, think of the death camps, think of napalm bombing and the hydrogen bomb and so on, not an entirely unjustified fear. The idea of the magus, the magician, M-A-G-U-S, becomes a very important one during the period of the Renaissance. And not a few contemporary scholars have claimed that in the magus, we have the major source of the idea of mastery over nature. This would not totally contradict Lynn White's thesis that this motif goes back to biblical ideas, but it would certainly cast it in a reasonably different light. And I think today it's hard for us to understand how widespread among the educated throughout Europe was this interest in alchemy and magic. Let me just give you a few quotes to illustrate this. In his writing called The Uncertainty and Vanity of the Sciences, the writer Agrippa von Nettesheim wrote in 1527, and I quote him, he says, "Therefore, natural magic is that which, having contemplated the virtues of all natural and celestial things and carefully studied their order, proceeds to make known the hidden and secret powers of nature. For this reason, magicians are like careful explorers of nature, only directing what nature has formerly prepared. Therefore, those who believe the operations of magic to be above or against nature are mistaken, because they are only derived from nature and in harmony with it." The magician, in other words, wasn't performing a bunch of hocus-pocus. The magician rather anticipated and assisted the outcome of natural operations. Renaissance magic had a great fascination with numbers, which may have led directly to the role of quantification in modern science. Leiss points out, and I quote, he says, "Numbers were regarded as providing the key to unlock the secrets and infinite powers of nature, and much mathematical genius was expended in the search for the correct formula." This fascination with numbers, he points out, almost certainly had an effect on later science in the attempt to conceive of or describe nature in mathematical terms. Francis Yates, that's F-R-A-N-C-E-S, in her book Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition, contends that the Renaissance conception of the magus was a critical step in the development of modern thought. Yates detects in the figure of the magician, the magus, a, quote, psychological reorientation of the will toward action. A psychological reorientation of the will toward action. Man came to feel, she contends, that there was a real dignity in his actions aimed at changing the mundane world. The alchemist wanted to understand how nature worked. His methods were very different from those of modern science, but his aim, she claims, was almost identical. The great alchemist Paracelsus, I love his full name. His full name was Theophrastus Bombastus Paracelsus von Hohenstaufen. I used to sort of wow my kids by spieling off this name. I've never actually found out whether our term bombastic comes from that. If anyone knows that, I'd be interested to hear. I guess if I would go back to the large English dictionary, I could find that out, the Oxford. It's no wonder he changed his name, or at least referred to himself for short as Paracelsus. For a time, he was the city physician at Basel in Switzerland. He writes, and I quote, "The alchemist is he who helps to develop to the extreme limits intended by nature that which nature produces for the benefits of mankind." Notice another myth of ancient origins, but developed by Goethe and others, the Dr. Faustus legend, which became a very important literary motif during this time and later. Actually, it's not of ancient origins. It probably originated in the 16th century. It became incredibly popular in the years following, and I think the Faustus myth reflects a kind of craving to unveil and master the hidden powers of nature. But from a psychological standpoint, Yates and others point out, it seems that Faustus was obsessive in a way in his desire for control. And she points out that there's a kind of fundamental ambiguity reflected in the myth. This, I think, can be particularly well seen in Goethe's play and also in Thomas Mann's novel. On the one hand, an almost irresistible desire to control, to dominate, to have power over nature. And on the other hand, this desire arousing a complementary fear, an almost terrifying fear at times, and sense of guilt, represented probably best in the Dr. Faustus legend by the Diabolical Pact. As William Lice points out, the alchemists of the day hardly had the kind of success that warranted such fears, and yet, at a deeper level, the fears probably were entirely appropriate. Because I think the alchemists sense that out of this might grow someday that kind of power, and that that truly would be a fearful power. Listen to this passage from Agrippa von Nettesheim. He says, "But who can give soul to an image, life to stone, metal, wood, or wax? And who can make children of Abraham come out of stones?" That's a biblical reference there. "No one has such powers but he who has cohabited with the elements, vanquished nature, mounted higher than the heavens." This is the alchemist he's talking about. "Elevating himself above the angels to the archetype itself, with whom he then becomes co-operator and can do all things." I wish we had time to look at some more of this material. If you take a good look at just a whole range of literary material and social commentary during this period, you see this kind of ambivalent attitude, but on the whole, the fear was suppressed. On the whole, just the positive aspects of this new science were brought to full consciousness. Eliade, Carl Jung, the great Swiss psychologist, and others who have studied the alchemists intensively have argued that a thoroughly secular vision, I'm quoting Lice, a thoroughly secular vision of the alchemist's dream has become the driving spirit of the modern age. The alchemist's dream was a more religious or spiritual vision, but it was a vision that wanted power. Contrast this with the older contemplative attitude of Greek religion and philosophy, the attitude of the Jews and Christians that power ultimately belonged to God, not to human beings. But here was a movement that wanted to see this power in the hands of human beings. We wanted power over our environment. And Jung and others see here a thoroughly secular version of the alchemist's dream, that is in modern science. A thoroughly secular version of the alchemist's dream has become the driving spirit of the modern age. Eliade argues, according to Lice, and I quote, that the concepts of material progress and the conquest of nature through science and technology crystallized in the 19th century and became the basic social ideology which still persists today. It is in the specific dogma of the 19th century, he writes, according to which man's true mission is to transform and improve upon nature and become her master, that we must look for the authentic continuation of the alchemist's dream. And thus, according to Eliade, the alchemists anticipated what is in fact the essence of the ideology of the modern world. Let's find power and control over nature and the world about us. I'm not totally convinced Eliade's right. I think Eliade and Yeats and others may underestimate some of the more religious and spiritual dimensions of alchemy. But even if they're wrong in part, I think the thesis is suggestive. I think it points us to a fundamental watershed type of shift between an older attitude towards reality that in many ways was more contemplative, more ordered towards understanding, or in the case of Judaism and Christianity, a relationship of obedience and aligning one's will with the will of God as over against an attitude of power and control. If we had time, we'd go back a little and look at Francis Bacon. Some of you might like to look at his writing, The New Atlantis, which was published posthumously in 1627. It's a marvelous discussion of the role that the Research Institute was to play in the world of his time, and so on. But it seems to me that in all of this material, we get this sense that human beings will be in charge, they will have power, they're moving away from the more contemplative relation to reality. The work we're reading this week, I think, is a wonderful fictional account of some of these issues. It's a kind of science fiction novel that elaborates on a much briefer thesis that C.S. Lewis presents in his little book, The Abolition of Man. It's a wonderful little book of about 60 or 80 pages, The Abolition of Man. And I'd like to call your attention here, in part as background for That Hideous Strength, to the chapter, The Conquest of Nature. I have a kind of humorous sense as I shift from the one part to the new part here of the value of technology, because my older notes here, I got interrupted last night. I wanted to revise them and put them in larger type, and I didn't have time to do it, so I was working with the older typewriter type, and I can't read them at a distance because of my trifocals. But now with technology, I can now leave my notes 3 feet or so from where I'm standing, and I don't have that that strain. The computer is wonderful. You just put it in about an 18, whatever you call it, point to type. But just that little bit of myself in reserve sort of smiling. Here I'm talking against technology in some ways, and yet technology has these kinds of obvious advantages. Lewis asked the question in The Abolition of Man, in the chapter The Conquest of Nature, in what sense is man, and I'm going to not translate man because it's the word he uses. I usually try to use terms like human being, but it makes it hard to translate this at every point. He says, in what sense is man the possessor of increasing power over nature? What we call man's power, Lewis contends, is in reality a power possessed by some men which may or may not allow other men to profit from it. Lewis points to a very, very interesting aspect of science and technology. We speak of power over nature, but that really is shorthand, in a way, for the fact that power over nature is not democratically shared. Power over nature is usually the power of a few people over nature, the scientists, the people who control the scientists, the military, and so on. And it's a power over nature which may or may not work to the benefit of other people. Bombs represent, Lewis points out, a certain power over nature, but don't forget that we may be on the receiving end when it comes to bombs. So the technology is never simply our power over nature, mankind's power over nature. It is the power of some people over nature. Contraceptives, genetic manipulation, selective breeding. We gain a certain power over nature, but in an interesting way, we also gain a certain power over subsequent generations. If we are to change, for instance, the genetic makeup of human beings, this means that those people who come after us in some ways don't have more power, in some ways they may have less power, because they will be the patients of our own power. Let's say we learn how to redesign human beings so that they are what we today want them to be, in some ways they will be less powerful because they will be the victims or patients of our own power. Let me elaborate on this in terms of a thought experiment that Lewis does in The Abolition of Man. In a sense, this whole chapter is a thought experiment. Lewis says, and it's fascinating to realize, that the book was written, I think, around 1945. In many ways, it's prophetic because it was written long before our understanding of DNA and RNA and genetic manipulation and so on. And if anything, his thesis would be far more powerful and convincing today than when he wrote it. But he says, let's imagine that a generation arises sometime in the future. He thought it would be quite long in the future, but perhaps it won't be. A generation that is able to design the human being of the future through eugenics and what Lewis calls scientific indoctrination and so forth. And today the et cetera would include clearly genetic manipulation. And Lewis then says that this science and technology represents a certain power over nature, including human nature. In reality, though, he warns us, and I quote him, if any one age really attains by eugenics and scientific education the power to make its descendants what it pleases, all men who live after it, that is, after that generation, are the patients of that power. And Lewis asks, will these human beings of the future be stronger than us? Will they have more power over nature than we do? On the contrary, Lewis argues, and I quote, the last men, the last human beings, far from being the heirs of power, will be of all men most subject to the dead hand of the great planners and conditioners, and will themselves exercise least power upon the future. The real picture, he says, is that of one dominant age. Let us suppose the 100th century AD. He is thinking way in the future, which resists all previous ages most successfully and dominates all subsequent ages most irresistibly, and thus is the real master of the human species. Let me read that again. He says, the real picture is that of one dominant age, which resists all previous ages most successfully and dominates all subsequent ages most irresistibly, and thus is the real master of the human species. But even among this generation, the power will be exercised, says Lewis, not by mankind in general, but by a small minority, those who possess the political and technological and scientific and military capability to enforce their will on others. The omnicompetent state and the irresistible scientific technique come together. Ooh, I have a huge problem here. I couldn't find my book this morning in the office, and I was going to quote some passages. You don't, pardon? Yeah, you don't have it with you, do you? Oh, let me have it, Jim. I got stuck this morning and went off without it. Thank you very much. I hope it's the same pagination. That's what happens when you work in two offices. Let me read a section from page 72. I think this will... He says, for the power of man to make himself what he pleases means, as we have seen, the power of some men to make other men what they please. In all ages, no doubt, nurture and instruction have in some sense attempted to exercise this power. But the situation to which we must look forward will be novel in two respects. In the first place, the power will be enormously increased. And he goes on and says how much more power the technicians and scientists will have than the older educators. And the second difference is even more important. In the older systems, both the kind of man the teachers wish to produce and their motives for producing them were prescribed in what he calls the Tao, a kind of system of objective values, a norm to which the teachers themselves were subject and from which they claimed no liberty to depart. But in this new age, claims Lewis, when people have become moral relativists, part of the book is a diatribe against moral relativism, he asks, what will these scientists and politicians, the ones he calls the conditioners, what will they base their judgments on? If we are going to redesign the man of the future, how should we do that? Particularly, how should we do that if the moral relativists are right? And the book, in part, was written, as is That Hideous Strength, as a kind of argument against radical subjectivism or moral relativism. On what basis will the conditioners make their decisions? Because they've rejected objective moral truth, they've rejected anything like a human essence, and they've argued there's no rational basis for making decisions about how to redesign the human beings of the future. What does this entail then for them? Are these people of the future free? Are the conditioners free to design the human being of the future in whatever way they choose? Yes, in a certain sense, they would be free to do this. But what does that really mean? And here again comes this very interesting term that we've worked with through the semester, the term freedom. What would be their pattern, their standard, their model? If these conditioners have rejected traditional concepts of value, Lewis argues, if they really act out of their moral relativism or subjectivism, then they will have just one thing left to act on at any given time, and that is, says Lewis, their particular wants or desires or feelings of the moment. Here we are about to redesign the human being of the future, says Lewis, but we're in a world, he says, where many people have rejected objective values. Now, on what basis do you do this? How do you decide what kind of human being you ought to design if everything is relative and up for grabs? Will they just follow their momentary impulses? Which ones? Wouldn't they be under the tyranny of their momentary whim? Will they follow their instincts? If so, again, which ones? On what basis would they follow some more destructive instincts or desires as well as, or on the other hand, some that are more beneficent? And Lewis argues in a marvelous section of the book here, he says, by the logic of their own position, having rejected objective values, they must just take their impulses as they come. That is, they don't have any standard or principle to sort out their various desires and impulses and instincts, so they just have to take them one after another as they come, that is, in a kind of chancy way, and their decisions thus ultimately rest on a kind of fortuitousness or chance. And then Lewis concludes, he says, at the moment then of man's victory over nature, we find the whole human race subjected to some individual men, and those individuals subjected to that in themselves which is purely natural, that is, their irrational impulses, nature untrammeled by values, rules, objective values, all of this leaves the conditioners in the situation that they're acting just by chance, and Lewis argues that looks not as if they are really exercising power over nature, but as if nature is finally exercising its own power over them. He says, man's conquest of nature turns out in the moment of its consummation to be nature's conquest of man, he argues nature ends up conquering man. Now, what does he mean by that? What he means is that if you take nature as just a kind of meaningless affair with mass and energy and causality, if you think of life as something that has arisen in a totally fortuitous, chancy way based on chance mutations and natural selection, but not having originated in any purposive or meaningful or teleological sense, then oddly, when you get to this point that he envisions in the future, that we are controlling nature, we have this anomaly that at the very moment when it looks like we will exercise our final power or control over nature, we have no reliable standards by which to make judgments. We can only take our various impulses and desires and instincts and so on as they happen to come to us. That looks, says Lewis, very much like what nature was apart from culture, apart from meaning and values. It looks much more like where the animals were or are. And thus, paradoxically, it looks not as if we end up conquering nature, but nature conquers us and indeed abolishes us. And I think this is incredibly interesting in light of what's happened in the field of genetic engineering. Once we start tampering with the human genetic makeup, on what basis do we do this? How do we make decisions about what's an improvement and what's not, or even if we should try to improve the species? Now, to some extent, we've been doing this for centuries through our feeble attempts at medicine and sanitation and so on. We've done it with animals more rigorously through selective breeding. But it would seem as if we are turning a corner where the power to reshape ourselves, even to combine the human genetic inheritance with animal genetic material and so on, has potentially become so huge that we could bring about enormous changes in the human beings of the future. And if Lewis is right that we attempt to do this in a world where there are no fixed moral standards, but only chance, doesn't it seem to be the case that nature ends up conquering us rather than we conquering nature? A marvelous little essay, and I wanted to lay out the main outlines of it here for you. Jim and Carl, I'd like to take the last 10 minutes to get a little reaction. Could you get the little loudspeaker things? And I'd just love to see if I'm getting through and what your reactions are to this. Because I think a fair amount of the course so far has led up to this kind of argument by C.S. Lewis, that there is a very, very close connection between the whole issue of moral relativism and our treatment of nature. And here Lewis tries to focus it on the issue that in a radically relativistic world, we may not end up being the masters of nature, we may end up being conquered or even abolished by nature. How do you react to that thesis? Any reflections? I'd love to know what you're thinking at this point before I go on. And I want to use the little hand mic so that we can get it on the tape. What do you think? Does that thesis sound plausible to you? Reactions. Yes, Leah? Hold the mic up close, about an inch or so from your mouth so we can all hear. Yeah. Can you turn it on, Jim? No, it's not working yet. the switches are not always as clear as they should be on that. Is that on, Kevin? See if that one's working. Technology lets us down. Maybe we won't be abolished after all.
Is this one?
Okay. Yeah, see if Kevin can work the other one.
The question that I'm having right now is, it sounds like the conclusion that nature conquers us, mm-hmm. that he comes to, he thinks is a bad thing, and I'm wondering why.
Well, what do you think? Is it a bad thing if we're abolished? If we're conquered, what do you think?
I don't know. It seems like he's operating under the assumption that man should be controlling nature to some extent. And I'd like to hear some justification
for
that.
Okay, I think Lewis is rather operating, I think that he is, but I think he's rather operating on the assumption that we have no choice. I think the idea that human beings should not dominate nature or should not have power over nature is a very, very bizarre concept because we have no choice. I think what the reality that we live with is that as soon as the forebrain exploded and enlarged in the way it has, I think we have no choice. The whole issue, as I see it, is not whether human beings control nature. It's how we do it. Because I think once you learn to control fire, use tools, once you learn language, this gives you power that I think inevitably you are going to use. And I think with great justification. If you're able to protect your children from a marauding tiger, or if you're able to store up a little food to save your family from famine, and so on, you will do it. So to me, that question, Leah, has always been a strange question. People like to be very hard on the early chapters of Genesis that talk about human beings having dominion over nature. I think that's a non-issue. I honestly believe that that is a total non-issue, because empirically we simply have that power, and we've always had it as long as we've been Homo sapiens. The only interesting question is, how do we use it? Does that... What do the rest of you think? Down in front here, Carl. Yeah.
Like the way you started your lecture saying that technological control is secondary, I think that's really important, that we're not controlling nature for the sake of controlling nature as a final goal, but rather it's just our role in the world, and we need to accept that role rather than deny that, you know, we don't have this control.
Okay. I think this is right, and this then ties in very, very closely with the kind of Niebuhrian analysis, that it seems as if much of our attempts at control are obsessive. They're compulsive. And the reason they're obsessive and compulsive is because we are using our power and control over nature to justify ourselves and deal with our anxiety and try to establish a kind of security that is more than we really need. So that it's not the control that is evil, it's the compulsive quality of it. Look back to the Merton reading. We have certain real needs for food and shelter and so on, but those are not that hard to meet. It's when the collective convinces us that we have all these other needs, that, you need two cars and three houses and so on, that it becomes compulsive and so on. So then my argument is that the talk of domination itself is fruitless. The interesting conversation is, why are we so obsessive in our control? Does that make sense?
Yeah. One question I have is, it doesn't seem to me like people are obsessive compulsive about domination. It seems to me it's more a general rule that people are cautious about how they use technology, and it's It's more the exception that, you know, you drop a bomb.
You are much more optimistic in a way than I am. Look at some of the cultures that have been more relaxed. I don't know how much of the idyllic South Sea Island culture anthropologically is accurate. I've always wished it were, but there's some doubts as to how accurate Margaret Mead and others were. But we at least can envision a world where we weren't so tired and harassed and driven. And you know, I think this is open to quite different interpretations. My sense is that we are a driven people. I will make that first person singular. I'm a driven person much more than I would like to be. And I keep asking myself, why? And that's where the Niebuhrian type of analysis for me is very useful. It seems to be a kind of abortive attempt to establish my own security, but often at the expense of other people and of nature. But I think this is precisely what the course is designed to do. I don't think there's one simple answer to those questions, so it's possible you are more nearly right. But what I want us to do is just to reflect on the issue. I think there's nothing wrong with having control over nature. In fact, we wouldn't survive as a species without it. Even in their own way, animals don't survive without some control over nature. It's just that their control is usually incredibly more limited. But it's when the control gets out of control that I think it threatens to destroy us. The hydrogen bomb is a wonderful symbol. It's supposed to make us more secure as a nation, but most of us aren't convinced. Any other reflections on this? I think the Lewis argument helps tie together some of the earlier part of the course with the latter part of the course. And that hideous strength is just a delightful fleshing out of this argument. Yeah, notice in the one hand the kind of compulsive, obsessive dimensions of nice and this role of science and so on, and on the other hand, the rather relaxed relationships at St. Anne's, and notice on some of the pages the sense of earthiness and the soil and the animals, and there's not this interest in sort of exterminating and controlling and sterilizing everything. It's a very ecological sort of relation with one another and the animals and the earth. Notice the discussions in the book where they talk about brainwashing Mark and everything is tried, they're trying to get away from absolute standards and so on. Everything is relative and shifting, and there are no objective values on which to make these decisions. It's an incredibly interesting discussion of this kind of thesis. And of course, Lewis's point is that this kind of power that we have in a world where people are relativists is an incredibly dangerous power. It's dangerous enough where they're not relativists, but at least there might be some possibility of controlling it in a benign way. But, you know, in my more pessimistic moments, I sometimes sense that if there ever were civilizations like our own spread throughout the universe, I think it's quite possible. I don't really believe this because I'm not sure God would allow it, but maybe he would. They got to about our stage of development and then self-destructed. I think it's incredibly likely, apart from some mysterious divine presence, that in the next 4 or 5 centuries we're going to self-destruct. I mean, what will happen when we have the kind of knowledge that would permit any schoolboy or schoolgirl in high school to make the doomsday weapon? What do you do? I think it's possible that that will happen. And so I think Heilbronner and others of the pessimists in some ways may be right. As a Christian, I hope and tend to believe that they may not be, but they may be right that we may inevitably be heading towards tyranny. Because I think the threat of the kind of thing C.S. Lewis is talking about is so huge that we're going to be running scared. Now, that's a very gloomy forecast for you all, but I think the argument at least needs to be looked at very carefully. Okay, Carl, you will be taking your sections? Good. Have a great vacation. Yeah.